Ladies and gentlemen, our special guest speaker will provoke you. He will inspire you. He is Creed Bratton.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Two eyes, two ears, a chin, a mouth, 10 fingers, two nipples, a butt, two kneecaps, a penis. I have just described to you the Loch Ness Monster. And the reward for his capture? All the riches in Scotland. So I have one question. Why are you here?
Well, I guess the question is with this too, it's like, I'm really fascinated sort of by your perspective, because the book is 40 years old. I mean, you've looked at this now for 50 years. I'm sure after we can talk a little bit about sort of like how you got out of the whole field, but I'm sure you didn't just stop having an interest.
I didn't really get out of the field.
Well, I know, but you know what I mean.
The field just grew bigger and I grew smaller within it.
Hey, that's a great, I like that. I'll start using that myself. But I mean, what do you think of the idea just that the lake monsters that we didn't see, that academia didn't pick it up, that it's still sort of in the fringes of the mainstream, if you will. You know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of disappointing that we haven't seen any real biologists sort of try and tackle this. They just refuse to even, they just dismiss it all out of hand.
I think there are also things that have to be borne in mind about how we've been sort of, how things have changed about conditions for observation. And one of the things that's very striking, for instance, about my book, True, but also about Bernard's large book about the sea serpent, is that, he's divided up into historical periods, and I do in my book as well. So much of the material comes from the 17th, 18th, 19th, and early 20th century. Now, in the case of, we'll say the great sea serpent, the problem about this is this relates to the expansion of sailing ships from Europe and America all around the world, but they were sailing ships. And the problem about it is that they say, oh, sailors at sea, they used to see creatures. Well, they saw creatures at sea because the ships, the sands, were essentially silent. They moved through the water with the power of wind. They didn't have engines. Sea serpent reports tend to sort of, in a way, go down when you have the increased, when the ship becomes steam driven and then now with newer engines. And nobody goes on the water. You can see this wherever there are boats in North America. People are roaring around with their Evinrudes all roaring behind them. And they create simply too much noise, both ships and recreational boat users, for any animal to want to go anywhere near them.
Yeah.
So the number of things are likely to, if you want to see something, you've got to sit quietly and wait for it to arrive. You can't sort of go pottering around in high powered boats and expect to see shy creatures who flee the sight of your noise. And the other thing is that the nature of the press, I think, changed over this period, because the 17th, 18th, the 19th century saw the emergence of the original newspapers turning slowly into larger newspapers and then into giant newspapers. And the 1930s, when the Loch Ness Monster came along, was really the great heyday of newspapers. It was certainly that first part of the first part of the 20th century in both America and Europe, was the heyday of newspapers. Newspapers began to decline in their popularity and reach with the introduction of radio, which is generally 1922, and then with television, which we'll say is about 1945, 1950.
Yeah.
And the sea serpent and lake monster reports decline away due to the change in the environment, to the change in the media that are going to be reporting them, because the press has now grown smaller and doesn't report things like this. And the radio and television news take a very different approach to stories. A story on in a newspaper may be sort of 500 to 1,000 words long.
Yeah.
What's the length of a story that appears on radio or television? It's you know, sometimes 20 words to 100 words. So there isn't simply the volume of reporting, ironically, that there once would have been back in the early 20th century or the 19th century.
Yeah, you also have the issue sort of that, like, local news seems to be kind of on the wane. So I don't know how it is over where you are, but here in the United States, it's like...
Well, that's very true, too, because
yeah.
One of the phenomena of 19th century America is the extraordinary numbers of local papers. Every time you set up a town, somebody was there with a printing press to print a four-page paper.
Right.
And some of these papers grew into sort of larger papers. And in fact, you know, the anomaly that always, the odd titles of American papers in the view of Europeans, you know, the sort of Topeka Herald Times, Clarion, well, I'm inventing this, of course. These are the results of papers coming together into one paper. But certainly local papers were a phenomenon in America. And when I was still in America in the 1970s, in Ann Arbor, where the University of Michigan was, there was an excellent newspaper, the Ann Arbor News, a magnificent paper, that because it was in a university community, it carried serious news and serious journalism about the arts and sciences and politics and foreign affairs and whatever. The paper has now disappeared. It's gone.
Yeah.
The Ann Arbor News. And some of them then have changed into sloppy newspapers, have turned into advertising sheets. And, you know, the whole nature of journalism, I think, has changed. And with it has the nature of what gets reported has changed.
Yeah. And it's difficult too, you know, like you said, television picked up so big, and this is it's obviously a visual medium, and so someone sees a Lakemont, you know, they need sort of like the visual aspect of it, and that can be difficult with a phenomenon like lake monsters.
That's very true, but it's that was one of the things, for instance, I mentioned from when we were first starting out, I mentioned one of the things, the very key thing that inspired my interest was seeing the transmission of Tim Dinsdale's film in the early 1960s, the 1960 of what he had taken. Now, the interesting thing about that was that film, which wasn't terribly long, but it got onto the BBC in what was a flagship news program, news magazine program called Panorama. And he was given something like 15 or 20 minutes to show the film and discuss it and whatever. Now, that just simply doesn't happen now. Television news programs do not respond in that kind of way. And an item about a lake monster would be at the end of the evening, and
yeah.
It would be the lightweight little item that would close the show. It wouldn't actually be, and I doubt if anything about Loch Ness would now get on the modern version of Panorama on the BBC. But if you look at NBC, CBC or ABC, CBS, I know ABC, you'll see exactly the same kind of thing. The news programs have become retrenched, and you know, documentaries have taken a different direction.
Mm.
And I think documentaries, with the growth of cable television and multi-channels, in order to compete, they have to make themselves a bit more sensational.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know,
yeah.
And you can see that in all kinds of reporting relating to cryptozoology of any kind, that you know, the whole experience has to be heightened. And largely heightened for a stay-at-home audience who are probably sitting on their couch, sort of eating their popcorn, with no intention of going anywhere near a forest, but just just want to see whether those young men are actually going to encounter this Sasquatch maybe get attacked by it. You know, that everything is very slightly hyped up, and you can see the same thing in a lot of the paranormal programs where, you know, the level of hysteria is hyped up in a way that's more akin to a horror film than it is to any traditional report of a true ghost story.
Right, right. They don't really resemble like an actual scientific expedition anymore. Maybe when they first started out they did, but now it's just ridiculous sort of showmanship, so it's pretty crazy. Now, if you, having looked at this mystery for so long, if money were no object, I like to present this sort of to the Bigfoot researchers. This is a good one for you, too. It's like, if money was no object and time was no concern and, you know, I called you up and said, Peter, I just hit the lottery, you know, what's the best way to go about sort of tackling this mystery to get to the bottom of it as far as lake monsters go? Like, maybe, do you have one place in mind that you think would be the very best place to go to put the best team in place? And what would be the means and the method you would use to sort of
get information? Well, I must say, I'm not sure that I would go to Loch Ness. I think one would. I think, on the whole, I mentioned the Great Lakes and the Rocky Mountain lakes, but the actual place that might be the most interesting would be to go back to the one that I mentioned earlier, Lake Okanagan in British Columbia, which is a very long lake. It's quite an interesting place. It has vantage points and sandy beaches. It's deep, but it's not quite as sheer as Loch Ness. It has towns around the edges of it, so there's more people, more witnesses. And I think a better chance of actually tabulating reports, getting eyewitnesses around the lake. You see, Loch Ness is actually got, there's a big town to the top of Lake Loch Ness, Inverness, but it's not on the lake. You just have a couple of little villages as you go down, and it's a very, in a way, it's actually got very few people overlooking it. And this was one of the things when the first reports came in, that there was a new road, or an old road had been really revamped up, and cars were able to drive freely up and down with a very good view of the lake, because everything had been cleared away to make the new road. Mm. Now, the thing about it is that things have changed now, things have grown up, and it's more difficult to see the lake. But the problem about it was that there was a new community of people moving up and down the lake. Now, the thing is with Lake Okanagan is you've already got the communities established, and you just need to coordinate it. And I think I'd go back there. And it's also perhaps a quieter sort of, British Columbia is a sort of quieter atmosphere for conducting cryptozoological research than perhaps Washington State, if you could follow the Canadian temperament is less sort of given to theatricalities than the American temperament.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it might be the ideal place to do it. And also, the climate is very pleasant. Loch Ness can be a very unpleasant place in wintertime. It may be quite attractive in looking in summertime. And that's an important thing. If you're going to conduct research, you want to conduct it all the year round.
That's the question I was going to ask you. That's sort of couched within the question, I guess, is like, what do you think is the best way to get to the bottom of this? Because I know they tried sonar or something like that in Loch Ness, and it didn't pan out as well as had been hoped. So, I mean, is there any sort of technology that can be used?
I think there's a lesson to be learned from zoology here in the widest sense. I mean, when I was at college and taking courses in anthropology, we used to do a certain amount about primate research and whatever. And the standard book about the great apes in those days was research done by a man called Yerkes. Now, he had been studying monkeys, but he had been studying monkeys in a confined situation on an island in a research center, right? It's rather like sort of studying, going to Sing Sing or to a big jail somewhere in the United States and studying the inmates and seeing them as representative of the larger American society. You're not just studying a community under stress and pressure and whatever. It's not a genuine one. And a lot of research into animals in the 19th century was done on the basis of that kind of thing, what you can see in a zoo, or what you can learn from killing the animal. It was actually only with people like in Africa, like Schaller, who set out to sort of study lions, and Diane Fossey with the gorillas and whatever, that you just sit there and you see what's to be seen. You don't actually interfere. You just actually observe the animals. And of course, when they started observing primates in the wild, they turned out to be quite different from what was observed by Yerkes with his imprisoned monkeys. And you actually have to, you know, every time there's a phrase in forensic science, every contact leaves a trace. So what you actually want to do is kind of develop some kind of research that is contactless, if you understand what I mean, that you want to be able to just observe and see what's there without actually imposing anything into it by way of sonar or nets or anything. You just try and see what is there to be observed, in the same way that, you know, Schaller would have observed the snow leopard, we'll say. And in that sense, you then begin to learn what is actually really there, but that you're not interfering with, or that you're not creating by your interference.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense, if you follow all of that.
I think it makes sense. You're saying you need more of like a detached observer perspective on this if you're going to really try and study it rather than sort of go out and try and get it. So you're not sort of of the opinion.
I think a lot of expeditions are gung-ho with their submarines and their sonar and whatever. Actually, the sonar is basically projecting sound into the water. And you know, you're not going to be able to see anything that way, because anything will sort of flee away from it. But I think that would be the right way to go about it. But I, you know, every day I go down the street and I see everybody sort of looking at their tablets or their iPhones or whatever. And I just wonder whether we're moving into a culture where nothing ever gets observed in a sense, unless it's actually digitalized, perhaps. You know, I'm not sure that people are capable of observing anymore.
It's scary in a way. You know, you go to like a rock concert, and half the people are filming it on their, watching it on their phone while they're there. It's like, put the phone down, just enjoy the experience.
Or they're taking selfies of themselves. But, I mean, one of the things, for instance, and to go back to Ivan Sanderson for a minute, in Ivan Sanderson's book about the Sasquatch or Bigfoot, and he was talking about sort of areas of Northern California, Washington, Oregon, that sort of area. And he was saying that when you actually looked on the map, it all looks mapped, he'd say, but then when you actually examine the thing, you see, of course, that the actual incidence of roads is very little. And there are whole areas that actually perhaps people don't actually go into all that often. And that nowadays, of course, one of the things is with everybody being motorized, and it'd be very difficult to sort of detach an American from his motor car, people just actually drive through places. The number of, so that it may well be that even a place like North America is in a sense quite not so much unexplored in a way, but actually unobserved in a way, because people simply aren't conscious of they just sort of pass through it rather than observe it.
Yeah.
Durrell, in one of his African books back in the 50s, he was in British West Africa as it was then, and He had a British official sort of come and look at the animals that they were going to take back to Britain, you see. And I thought there were boxes of this and boxes of that, and the official was looking at it, walked up and down and looking at them. And he said, goodness me, he said, I've never seen any of these. Are these very rare creatures? And Gerald Durrell says, no, they're all quite common. They're all out there. But the British administrator had not seen them. But even more surprising it was that some of the local people who had probably gone from their village into living town life were actually unacquainted with these creatures as well.
Yeah.
So there is a loss that in the old pre-colonial days when people lived out in the bush in Africa, or the Indians lived in the forest in a kind of reciprocal way, they knew the environment and they knew they interacted with it in a way that's quite different than people do now. Therefore they probably actually saw more and understood more about their environment in a kind of personal sense than people do now, when they actually derive a lot of what they think about the environment from what they're told by scientists or school teachers.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, people just aren't even that tuned into the environment anymore, so it's, you know, like you said about people looking at their tablets all the time, it's, we're getting further and detached from nature, frighteningly enough.
Yes. Things are very strange. I mean, a little while ago, my wife and I were with a party and we were visiting, Giverny Monet's garden near Paris. And when we came away, my wife was remarking, it's a remarkable garden or whatever. She said, did you notice the amount of bird song was in it? And the thing was, I said, well, yes, but actually we'd been there in the middle of the afternoon. And of course, you don't actually necessarily hear birds. You hear birds in the first thing in the morning or at night or whatever, or establishing their territoriality or giving warning in some way to their, but, we decided that the bird song was actually recorded and was being played out to set the atmosphere of the gardens.
What?
This kind of background, you like to get in a shop. And this is the problem about observing anything now, that even in a garden that you think is wonderfully wild, that the problem about it is it's not quite what you think it is. It's all, you know.
That's crazy.
And I think that's maybe the point about, you know, but the thing is also, I think one of the things is that it's very hard to, you know, the whole, just to broaden the thing about the paranormal in general, the problem about the Baron, you've constantly got skeptics saying, oh, they want to have all of this under scientific conditions, right?
Yeah.
In a lab, we'll say, and somebody wired up for sound and whatever. It's a bit like Yerkes monkeys on the island all over again, right? The problem about it is, if people are going to see a ghost, we'll just say, to take a different direction, it's going to be an unexpected encounter with something that is unusual by its definition.
Right.
And therefore, it can't actually be, you can't actually recreate it to demand in a lab. But so exactly the same kind of thing that Schaller and Diane Fossey were doing, and Baroness von Lawick, you have to actually sort of wait to see what the animals are doing. They weren't recreating animal life or whatever in a lab. They'd abandoned the lab. They'd abandoned the dissecting dish. They were trying to see what the life and the experiences of the animals really was when they were just left alone and observed. I'm repeating myself in this, but it does apply to the paranormal as well, that you can't expect it to meet the demands of some scientists, because that it's just actually impossible.
Now I want to circle back to
by definition, if they're paranormal, they're not normal. So
yeah, exactly. So why use normal means to study them? I want to circle back to sort of your idea of what these lake monsters are, so I can kind of dig more into it. You sort of put forward the idea of the warm-blooded mammal. So you're thinking that evolved from ancient creatures?
No, I think one of the things about it is, I was mentioning about ecological niches, but you have to remember too that people's ideas of what unknown animals are is rather shaped by their latest thinking. I mean, when the at one time, the great dinosaurs were unknown. They were only discovered in the, by starting with Gideon Mantell and Mariani and then the explorers in the west of America in the course of the early 19th century. And of course, then when they became the immediate answer, for instance, to observations of the sea serpent, and people sort of said, well, of course, if a report didn't seem to fit the model of being a plesiosaur, it was discounted. Well, of course, the way to go about it is actually to try and see what it is that people are observing and then explain it. I'm not sure that you can have a theory about what these animals are. That's to say, I mean, they could be, as people thought in Victorian times, a prehistoric survival. They could be, as some people, prior to that in the 18th century thought that they were sort of some kind of giant reptile. Or you could have it as my suggestion is that they're now in keeping with the general sort of biological nature of the evolutionary period we live in, that they're warm-blooded mammals. But the problem about it is you can't, if you start with the theory about what it is you're looking for, that may actually shape what you get to see. And the thing to do is, I think sometimes it may be better not to have any theories at all, but just to observe, as I say, what is actually going on. People sometimes say to novelists or whatever, you know, what is your book going to be about, or what are you going to write today? And they say, I don't know, because the book hasn't told me. And the point is that you have to explore what is there and see what comes out of your exploration, and not impose your ideas on the world around you. Let the world impose itself on you. And I think maybe that's an important dimension to everybody's thinking. After all, many of your listeners are keenly engaged in paranormal experiences. But one of the problems about it is one has to actually be open to things, and not to say, oh, something is paranormal or this is quite normal. I mean, one of the things about Watson's supernature book was the thing that he brought out, that we can't actually know what is paranormal. We can't even know what is supernatural, or as he would have said, a level above nature, supranatural. Because unless we actually know, we don't know enough to know what these things are.
Right.
It may well be that at some level of newer understanding that might emerge, these things are perfectly, they're not paranormal at all, they're perfectly normal, but we just didn't understand them.
Exactly. Now, you kind of joked about how the field got bigger and you got smaller, but talk a little bit about, you know, you...
Well, it certainly is an expanding, it was an expanding thing. I mean, when I started out, we'd say in 1960, we'd take about Loch Ness now. There was a book published in 1934 about Loch Ness by Rupert T. Gould. The next book about Loch Ness wasn't published until 1954. And then the next book after that, that was by Constance White. The next book after that was one published about 19, it was Tim Dinsdale. And then there was another one by Maurice Burton. So suddenly a whole group emerged in the 1960s. And then about 1965 or thereabouts, the whole thing began to expand. Now, one of the differences about these books was that the Rupert Gould and Mrs. White and Maurice Burton and Tim Dinsdale, they were actually by people who had been investigating the whole problem. One of the things was that as soon as there seemed to be a market there, publishers began producing books to meet the market, fill the market niche. And therefore a different kind of quality emerged. You got books that were rather sort of, pasted together, sort of, you know, cut and paste books, instant books, journalistic books, sensational books, books that sort of, reduced a very complicated story to a two-page synopsis of an event, and so that a large, even though a lot of the books were published, the quality of them went down. The more books that are published, the poorer they get. You can see it. You only have to go into your local Barnes and Noble to be able to see that at work, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that affected the thing. Now, and in among all those, there were still excellent books based on a lot of research and a lot of inquiry. And also, in a sense, there were, you know, you had to also leave a space for people with new ideas. We'll say like some writer like John Keel, perhaps, that have sort of bizarre ideas, but then actually sort of just enlarge your idea of what is actually possible. But then there's an awful lot of people out there who are prepared to exploit people. You know, one of my other interests is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and one of my more recent books was a book about Conan Doyle as a criminologist, as interesting crime as a theme through his life. But in the last years of the last 13 years of his life, he seriously devoted himself to spiritualism. Now, not to psychical research so much as to actual spiritualism. Mm-hmm. And it was a very sad decline, in a sense, because he moved from being what the original psychic researchers had been, which was investigators, into somebody who was trying to establish a kind of a cult of belief. There was a whole new dimension came into it. But beyond Conan Doyle, then there were all the people who were so busy exploiting people's desire after the Great War to actually, which we're now celebrating the centenary of, to exploit the losses of the Great War, which were so horrendous, to people's anxiety to communicate with loved ones they'd actually lost. So these elements that are at work, the investigator, the cultist, and the exploiter, I think you'll find those in every area and among the exploiters, you probably have to put some publishers. But even in each area, there'd still be worthwhile stuff, which is why one has to go through it all. But one has to be aware that one is dealing with a very broad spectrum of things. And I think that, running the show that you do, you must meet all kinds of people with all kinds of different ideas. But eventually, all these different kind of ideas will actually, some way or other, the ideas that are of value will probably last, and those that are just tentative or unfounded will fade away.
Absolutely, yeah. I've come to notice that over the years doing the show. Now, I guess to circle back on that question, though, it's like, what made you... You wrote In Search of Lake Monsters. I believe you had a follow-up book, but I'm not positive.
Well, I did. I had another book then.
On the track.
Called The Magic Zoo, explored the nature of, which was an exploration of the natural, it was called, subtitled The Natural History of Imaginary Animals. Mm. And it was dealing with sort of what you call classic creatures like the phoenix and the unicorn and whatever, and explaining the roots of them in some kind of in natural history. Now, less in natural history than in other elements of sort of mythology and whatever. And that was the point. It was based on the idea that I had was that they would be based on that these creatures emerged out of some natural fact that would then be sort of translated into new idea. Take, for instance, the phoenix. The phoenix is a sort of a bird that was said to sort of, an Arabian bird that built a nest and then laid an egg and then was sort of consumed by its own fire, whatever.
Yeah.
But the thing about it seemed to be a strange, it didn't, there were various ideas that archaeologists and historians had about what the phoenix was and how it related to ancient Egyptian religion or whatever. But the underlying biological fact, which was actually observed only clearly in the 1950s by Dr. Morris Burton in England, was that in fact some birds do actually go in for a procedure that he called bird anting. That they actually connect ants and they rub them all over their body in order to sort of have the effect of the formic acid. Yeah. But that they also used to perform this with sitting in a fire, that they'd sort of bathe in the actual smoke in a way. And he sort of illustrated this by the relationship between sort of birds' nests going on fire in thatched cottages. And that actually fire and birds in a biological situation that could be defined were associated just as they had been in the ancient legend of the phoenix.
Hmm.
Now that insight into what might have been the source of the original origin of the phoenix myth.
Yeah.
Was based on a biological observation of an exact kind.
Hmm.
Now the same is to some extent is true, for instance, of the legend of the unicorn. The legend of the unicorn has got itself confused because in medieval times when the Greenland coast became open to trade, or one might call it sort of unacknowledged North American trade, perhaps, and narwhal horns were brought down from the Arctic and spread through Europe. They were very rare, and the King of France had one, which you can now see in the Cluny Museum in Paris, that he paid a sort of huge fortune of. And these narwhal horns were seen to be unicorn horns, which is why the unicorn in so many pictures is a spiral horn, and they were used for testing the king's food for poison. But underlying this story of the unicorn is the fact that in parts of the world known to the classical world, in Africa and the Near East, the leaders of herds would actually not, the two horns would be taken off, they would be cut together, and a single horned animal would be created as a herd leader.
Huh.
And this was actually fully realized and experimented on biologically by an American scientist in Vermont in the 1920s. And so the book explores this kind of the natural history facts that underlie things. Now, I'd hope to actually get a new edition of this out in due course. But after that, however, I'd also pursued English literature studies at the University of Michigan, and so then I was actually writing in between these books a book about the literature of the Irish Revolution, and then literary studies of Joyce and Flann O'Brien and other Irish writers. So eventually, in the pressure of things, they that direction was the one that was followed in publishing rather than the cryptozoology one. But the point is that from doing all that other kind of research, I learned new techniques of research, and I sort of kept up my interest to some extent in cryptozoology, which is basically why the book has come back into print. And I think it possibly would have written from time to time on some aspects of it, but articles only rather than books. So perhaps if I ever eventually get to retire, I might write a few more zoological books in retirement. But in my mind, in a way, everything you do is connected up. I don't think we're quite, as I was saying to you earlier, looking at this book, there's references to Conan Doyle and to The Lost World and to Jules Verne and to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically they relate to other interests that I have. So one thing feeds on another, and something that you may learn from one thing you're researching will suddenly enlighten you as to that something is something else. And it's only academics that you meet and you ask them about something and say, oh, I wouldn't know about that. That's not my field. But a writer like myself, who's a sort of is an actor, not in an academic post, and writes for a freelance writer, there is no such thing. Nothing is alien to one, if so to speak. If one is a freelance writer, and everything feeds into everything else, and everything connects, you know, so. Decompartmentalizing is rather like putting the material that makes up the world into prison cells. You know, you've got your mass murderers there and your sex offenders there, and so sort of you never mix them up, that sort of thing. Whereas in fact, in real life, everything is mixed up. You know, and you know, your celebrated poltergeist may be working at work in a sort of ordinary suburban house rather than a traditional haunted mansion.
Exactly. Now, is there any? You know, people tend to think of these things, these lake monster cases, as sort of like tales from the past. Is there anything in recent times that has caught your attention where you're like, wow, this is really interesting?
I don't think by any means that these are tales from the past.
Right,
this is,
right.
This is part of the problem. I mean, there are a few magazines, for instance, like 14 Times, and a few writers like Lauren Coleman, who go on assiduously reporting things based. It's just, I think that things have changed. In the way that things actually get reported. I think that certainly strange creatures remain to be found. And I think that it just requires a different approach. And I think that it's up to sort of the media to change its habits. I think in a way that the media has actually narrowed down the range of interests that it thinks that people have. I think the people won't be interested in anything unless they sort of jazz it up completely. And I think that's a great pity. I don't know whether it's to do with the change in the way people are educated, or whether it's the interest in people generally, or the effect of sort of I'd suggest it's probably people who were provided with too much sport on television and it occupies too much time. and I think if you had less, personally, I could never see how this will offend some of your listeners. I could never in my life see the point of American football. And I think if less time were devoted to American football on television around the world, and probably soccer, there would be more time for interesting reports about cryptozoology.
Now, there's one sort of theory. I didn't see this in the notes really, but it kind of just crossed my mind when you were talking about that, where it's like, you know, just sort of a school of thought in some circles of cryptozoology, more on the fringes really than in the mainstream realm of cryptozoology, that there's sort of like a conspiracy to cover all this stuff up, that they don't want people to know. I don't know why they wouldn't want people to know about lake monsters, but because they're not necessarily monsters, really. They're just animals.
I think I can understand exactly where that comes from. And I think it has to do with this question that I was sort of saying about academics responding. They sort of, oh, it's not my field, or they want to sort of, as I was saying earlier, they want to preserve their thing. And they give the appearance of one of the things about, is that if you ask, if a newspaper rings up an academic in a local university and asks him, what do you think of a Bigfoot? He will inevitably have a response. Because he likes to see his name in print, kind of thing. But the problem about it is that then his response is bound to be kind of negative, as you can appreciate, largely is. And that gives the impression of people whose experience of events is different. They say, how can he believe that this is what actually happened? There must be some reason why he's not actually admitting that. And that gives rise to the idea, well, maybe that they just don't want it talked about. And I think perhaps that gives people the idea that, well, there's a kind of conspiracy to
cover it up.
You know, not to reveal these things. But I can't imagine, you know, why anybody would want to not sort of reveal all they know about lake monsters.
Right.
I can well understand why they might want to reveal all they know about the FBI or something, but
yeah.
it's a very strange thing. When I was living in America when the report on the Kennedy assassination came out.
Mm.
And the problem about that was at one stage I was quite interested in that and was certainly, but as time went on, I sort of had to give up reading books about the Warren Commission and the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
Because it became, one couldn't just hold it in your mind. And the same thing happened with the case of Jack the Ripper, because I lived in London for some years and near actually the East End where all these murders took place. And at that time, there were only about 4 books about Jack the Ripper. Now there are whole libraries about them,
yeah.
Exactly the same thing as about cryptozoology. But again, that moved from sort of people assiduously trying to investigate it to show what had actually really happened into now the most extravagant theories about conspiracy about involving the royal family and God, Russian, and the Russian intelligence and God knows what. I mean, I like the Warren Commission books, I have failed to keep up with Jack the Ripper. So I keep up with lake monsters to some extent, but there are some subjects that just get too big for you to actually be able to understand.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think that's just too imposing. But I can't, I think some people get the impression that you know, people don't want to divulge information. And it isn't actually the case. It's because sometimes people don't actually have any information to divulge. You know, that's the point about asking some academics what they think about, you know, sort of lake monsters. They really haven't actually looked at the evidence at all. They don't know the history of it. They haven't. They've assumed a certain number of things that they've read from skeptical popularizations. And they react on that basis to a current report. And it's actually not doing anybody any kind of good service at all, because it's not a truly critical report. And sometimes they would be more honest if they said, I simply don't know because I haven't studied the subject.
Oh, they'll never say that.
What? Well, they'll never say that, but you know, that's the truth of the matter, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem about it is there's no conspiracy out there. It's just a failure to admit ignorance.
Exactly. That's probably more in keeping with what's really going on than a grand conspiracy.
I suspect it is. And the other thing is, it's very difficult to have with all these big subjects. We can only actually perhaps grasp one small area of it, and then those other areas that we haven't grasped may be where the key to the solution actually lies, and that the solution is probably quite a simple one.
Yeah.
But because we can ever grasp at one time all the facts in our mind, the solution just eludes us constantly.
Yeah.
And therefore, people feel so frustrated that they say, "Oh, that there's a conspiracy to keep it all quiet."
Mm.
So I'm afraid but on the general point about people say they talk hazily about conspiracy theories, you know, conspiracies aren't a theory. People do conspire. I mean, you just only have to look at the course of English history, for instance, and you'll see the constant conspiracies.
Yeah.
I mean, they what would you call cutting off the head of the king? I do this and that is a conspiracy. you know, and all history is filled with conspiracies. So why would they suddenly have stopped sort of 20 years ago, you know, or when some new administration comes into power? Of course, people want to conceal facts from people. Largely, I suspect, in the case of governments, because they don't want to reveal to people how badly they've spent most of the money they've spent. But
yeah, or the laws they've broken.
Yes, but in the general case of lake monsters and cryptological matters generally, I think that the more we know, the better it'll be. But I think, as I was saying, strange creatures remain to be found. But my major thought these days would be that with the way that we're sort of treating the world around us, and not only through climate change, but also through human violence and the general destructiveness of people and what they do, they were so altering the world that the world is changing rapidly. And these mysterious creatures will cease to be mysterious for the simple reason that they've become extinct before we actually found anything out about them.
Yeah. Well, it's a challenge. I've had Adam Davies on the show. He's a big-time researcher of the Orang Pendek in Sumatra, and he makes the same point that we need to, you know, time may run out before we get the chance to finally get to the bottom of these things, which is a sad,
I don't think people, actually fully realize how change is affecting affects their lives. I mean, my wife has sort of said, you know, they demolished some houses that you knew 20 years ago. And then, you know, 6 months later when they build something, you have difficulty even remembering what the original looked like. And that's the problem. We're sort of so changing the world that we've now beginning to lose sight of what it originally looked like. You know, I think probably stuck in my mind that there's an idea of the world as how it probably looked about 1933 when the Loch Ness Monster was big purple, came on the scene. Because, one can't possibly keep trace with all the changes in these countries, and the way in which they look at Africa, which potentially for Mr. Pittman was filled with mysterious animals, is now almost totally urbanized country where villages have been abandoned for great conurbations. And so that's, you know, the natural Africa of the past is sort of dying away before one's eyes.
It's maddening in a way. Like we're saying here, time may run out before we get the chance to really get to the bottom of this thing. And time is running out on our conversation here because we've gone a couple hours. Now, what do you plan on doing anything else? I mean, this work was, in a way, it's kind of nice. It's like you put out this seminal work and you've got all of your life.
It's nice to have done something that's sort of, is still alive sort of so long after you've actually done the work on it.
Yeah, exactly.
I can tell you, it doesn't, any writer will tell you, it doesn't apply to all the books you write, you know. there's a handful of them that's hopefully we'll get on. I would certainly dearly like to do a new edition of The Magic Zoo, and try and sort of bring it back with larger illustrations and whatever. So I think that might be a project that I would put in hand, one way or another. But I'm also trying to do a new edition of my Conan Doyle book, as Conan Doyle as a criminologist, which is again a thing about investigation. And I suspect that if there's one constant theme in all the things that I've done, they're all dependent on a process of investigating and researching something. And it's possibly something to the fact that research and investigation is something that you can actually do on your own. So it's probably due down to some loner complex in my mind that I'd like to work on my own rather than in a company sort of thing, you know, which is why one is a freelance writer, I suspect.
Now, you alluded to possibly I thought you were kind of alluding to possibly doing something about regarding or covering or looking at the paranormal element to all this. Is that something that's crossed your mind? Maybe,
well, that was doing that was the one of the things that you were saying about the book. I think that was the one element in the book that was possibly weak, that at the time I didn't give it sufficient thought. I think it might be something that I would see in a larger dimension now. But, you know, I think that this, we tend sometimes to see ourselves as being outside nature rather than part of nature. And I think that this cryptozoology, if it does anything, ought to actually make people aware that our processes of thought and imagination influence how we see the world and appreciate the world. And they're actually integrated sides of the one thing, and that it's something that I would certainly like to explore more and to try and understand for myself in a sense, because it's a very mysterious kind of thing. And I being Irish and living in a country like Ireland that's steeped in sort of folklore and mythology. You know, you can't live in the country of sort of W.B. Yeats and sort of just thinking things are that the whole world is made of concrete sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be a dimension for the imagination, and the imagination is a factor of evolution and of life itself.
Very interesting. Yeah. Very. That's profound.
That would be where I would go. I would sort of try and combine a little more of W.B. Yeats with Bernard Hoverman's, and that would be a future project.
Nice, nice. Well, I look forward to that.
Well,
in the 40 years since you wrote the book, I mean, we talked about how cryptozoology got bigger and you kind of you went off to do other adventures and other books and stuff. Are you happy with sort of how...
Well, there were more people dealing with the problems that I pioneered, and I think it's bound to... That's bound to produce something new, and
you know, absolutely,
yeah, and that's a good thing.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Are you kind of like, what's your take? I guess, you know, because you were right there at the beginning with some of these early, you know, the first folks to sort of really be doing this stuff. What's your take on sort of how this research field has evolved over the years? Are you happy with where it's at now? Do you think it needs to change? Do you think it needs to do something differently? I mean, what's your perspective on sort of the evolution of this field over the last few years?
I think there's a point about it. And going back to the question of parapsychology for a minute, when the novelist Arthur Koestler died, he left his money for a chair of parapsychology, which went to a Scottish university, where somebody would be engaged in studying the sort of parapsychology. Now, it hasn't taken the course that he anticipated, but one of the things I would certainly like to see is that I think more of the cryptozoology, zoological research needs to be incorporated into the sort of mainstream of academic research. But for that to happen, academic research has to open itself up to a wider spectrum of what it is we can legitimately study, and that's important. I think it's one of the disappointments that the work that was sort of done by people like Bernard Hoverman's and other people like Rupert Gould and Mrs. White and whatever, and Lauren Coleman and whatever, it still remains a kind of outside of the accepted boundaries of what constitutes academic research.
Right.
And I think that's a disappointment. One would have thought that after this time that it would have actually sort of, actually there would have been a response that it would have enabled an integration of the two attitudes.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah. That's what you hope for, but.
I think that applies to a lot of areas of research, perhaps too, that are, you know, that present difficulties. It would be something that would apply to many of the other topics that your listeners are interested in.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right. Well, I've taken up a lot of your time here, so I'll sort of wrap it up here.
Well, I've taken up an equally large amount of your airtime. So
I've appreciated it. I really have.
I hope, it, hope it'll be entertaining enough for your listeners and whatever. And they'll find some, I think, find some benefit in reading the book, but it'll take them into areas, I think, that they hardly appreciated existed if they do read it.
Mm, absolutely. They should definitely check it out. I was going to say, you know, it's not very often that I get the chance to have somebody on the show who's written a seminal book in the field. So it's really, it was a thrill for me to get the chance to talk to you and present this work here and get your perspective on the changes and sort of the state of all this and how things have evolved and really the root of these mysteries. So I've really, Peter, your wisdom is unparalleled here in a lot of ways. And I, you know, it's just a real treat to be able to share it and get it on the record here for the listeners, you know.
Well, it's been an entertaining evening for me too, so and I hope for your listeners, and I hope they'll all be encouraged to get out in their canoe in their nearest lake and see what they can see.
Absolutely. So there you go, folks. The book, of course, is In Search of Lake Monsters. You can find out more about that at anomalistbooks.com. Peter, thank you so much once again for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it.
Not at all. It's my joy. Thanks.